And shall we?
Yep.
All right, what are we going to talk about today, Jeremy?
Well, that's your department, Ollie, because today's, I think, about digital marketing.
That's right. So today we've got a guest all the way from sunny Australia. Hello, Robin. Welcome.
Hi, Ollie. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, Ollie.
So Robin Forsyth.
Hi, Ollie. Hi, Robin.
You can say hi to me as much as you like, mate. I always feel welcome around you.
Very good.
So Robin is a digital marketing expert, and we've got her in today to really answer the question, when someone in the business says, we really need to get into digital, or we need to get our digital channels or our online presence working for us, we need to start selling online, what does that mean to the rest of us? So welcome, Robin, and tell us a little bit about you.
Thanks, Ollie. Yep. So I've been in digital marketing for, I think, 13 or 14 years now. I was actually really lucky to go to London just as digital and the internet and marketing on the internet really took off. I was part of, you know, the London agency scene that we were doing very, really creative, you know, homepage takeovers on the Sun, you know, where a car would come in from, you know, from the movie, a car would speed in and leave the name of the movie on top of the screen. And, you know, we don't even do that kind of advertising anymore because it's so invasive, but at the time it was really cutting edge. And so it's been a really interesting course over 13, 14 years to watch us evolve to a much more personalized space where digital marketing is more of a one-to-one strategy now rather than one-to-broadcast, which is probably where we started.
Right. And
can I just ask you a quick question, Robin?
Feel free, mate.
Would you consider yourself an old fox or a young fox?
I'm a little bit of an old fox in a new game, I think. I've been lucky enough. When I went to the UK, my first job was at an agency that specialised in movies. And I remember going for my interview and the woman was like, so we do everything online? We're like an online PR agency. And I was like, what? You don't print anything. And my mind was blown. But that was obviously the start of a, you know, a really long, happy career. So,
Very good.
Oh, yes, maybe an old fox in a new game.
Very good.
It's interesting the different answers we get from different people, isn't it? It's not about age, it's about perspective and what they're working on.
Indeed, the experience that they're having in the current moment, really.
Mm, indeed. Shall I get back to my question? All right. So when someone says digital in the context of digital marketing, what do they mean?
Well, everyone has a different perspective on that one. I believe that to be selling on the internet and mastering that skill. That's what I believe digital marketing to be. It's using the same tricks, like you guys said, the four P's, you know, product, price, place, and promotion. Those are the old school tricks from the old foxes, but those haven't gone out of fashion. It's just about the channels now and the speed to market. So it's faster. You've got to be faster to get your product together, faster to reach the right people in the right way. You know, businesses that I work in now all work in agile. So digital marketing has moved into the next stage, which is sort of digital business, really. You know, these whole businesses are being created, white label businesses, for example, that are being created and they don't have storefronts anymore and they're getting to market quicker and they're reaching their audiences quicker and they're standing on their own two feet quicker and the businesses are making decisions quicker on how do they understand their audiences better and add value to them? And how do they pivot if it's not working? It's all much, much faster these days.
Okay. Can you give us an example of what you mean by white label and what you mean by a business that's solely online?
Sure. So I'm talking about businesses that are able to power companies, all of these sorts of companies, Telstra, mobile phone companies, you know, Virgin Mobile in Australia just uses Telstra's towers, but they have a completely different business model. They have a different target audience. They have a different value offering. So by white label, I mean, you know, you can create businesses these days and even look at Uber. They do not own one car and yet they make billions of dollars per year and have hundreds of thousands of staff globally, but they do not own one car. So digital businesses in the context of the internet or the app or the service that they provide is actually what they sell. They don't need a storefront for that.
This is an interesting one for you, isn't it, Jeremy? I know you're aching to ask a particular question here.
Go on, tell me, which one's that, Ollie? Isn't that the role of the brand?
No, it's the move online and the move offline.
Yeah, I think it's this conversation that people have about the ways we've always traditionally done things, but through a new prism. And I think it's this thing about having multiple channels, multiple distribution channels rather than just one. Certainly in retailing, it seems that there's a movement back towards the understanding that the shopping experience is more than just an online experience. And some people are using the physical presence of a shop and the experience within a shop as a way of retaining some sort of differentiation, some sort of competitive advantage over the purely online role.
Absolutely. But, you know, you also, if you think about a business like Nike, so they have a storefront, but also their stores are very digital at heart. You know, their products are digital. They have trackers in T-shirts that hook up to your Apple Watch that tell you if you beat your personal best last time you ran. You know, they have trackers in shoes. Digital can be at the heart of the product as well as the marketing. And I think that's where we can really change as a society, is that is where we are going, is that products themselves will be more digital. You know, your fridge will be digital. Your fridge will order the milk and bread for you in the future. There's a really interesting debate around retail because there is always an element of convenience in buying in general. You know, would you cross the road to get the milk and bread if it was closer? Yes, you totally would. Why would you do that all versus buy on the Woolworths app where it takes 2 days to get to you? But the future is the fridge that understands that the milk is running out and it orders the milk for you so that by the time the milk arrives, you never actually run out of milk. So you don't need to cross the road to go to the corner store because the product itself is digital. You think the product is milk and bread, but the product is actually the fridge that knows you ran out of milk and bread.
Yeah, it's interesting.
The other key word that you used there was about integration. You know, integrating technology with the sort of buying...
the service.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, so the differences between selling something online and selling something in a shop or person to person. So maybe if we use the example of an accountant or the example of Nike.
Mm-hmm.
How is that process of marketing and selling different for them when they go online?
Sure. So Nike is a really fascinating business to watch because a lot of their things that they do in the digital landscape are free. They're value adds. They are more reasons for you to love the brand, but they are not actually trying to make money out of you. So if you are a fitness junkie and you are in their target audience, would they rather that you are using their competitor's app or their free app? They may have spent $1 million creating this app where there's, you know, all these fabulous movement exercises for all the way from beginners through to advanced people, right? But it's about engagement. So the next level, we are, as a community now, we are beyond, is e-commerce a thing? You know, if you don't have a website, you're already probably not in the game, you know, or you've probably gone out of business already. You know, we've seen this with bookstores globally go out of business and, you know, come back into business through a digital platform, you know, Audible, for example, books are online now. But with a business like Nike, it's all about if they have 2 million people engaged on their apps, the variety that they have, then are those people more likely at the end of the day to search their product online, prefer their product in a wholesaler store, choose that to go into the store when they actually see a bricks and mortar, choose to buy their shoes, et cetera, et cetera. So as an industry, it's not about are you online, did you get online, do you have a great Instagram channel, and this even moves to how many followers you have on Facebook or Instagram. It's not about that anymore. It's about actually, you know, setting the content free, being engaged with the brand. And in the end, the brands that have the more engaged customer base and the fans of the brand will win in the end. And that's why you see Nike worth a hell of a lot more than brands like Reebok and these kind of old school brands that have really not kept up with them.
And I imagine that social media has a really important role within this as well.
Which we'll come to in a minute.
Oh, fine, okay. I wouldn't mind just covering now, actually.
Go for it.
Can we? Because it's a conversation as opposed to a list of questions. I'm just intrigued about how you manage the two together. I mean, what are the challenges of managing social media with the main e-commerce marketing effort?
Well, that's the $99 million question. And I can't tell you how many articles are out there where people are trying to crack social media and they're trying to spend a lot. But since in big business myself, I've seen a lot of trends in social media. So when Facebook first started, big business was, you know, posting all the time and trying to buy customers and spending lots on advertising with homepage takeovers on Facebook to try and get people to see their product first.
Could you just define homepage takeovers?
Yeah, so back in the day, Facebook used to have an ad unit that sat on the Australian Facebook page. And if you had a movie coming out or a record, you could literally do a homepage buyout, like on The Age Australia or The Sun UK, these sorts of platforms. You could buy the homepage. But Facebook obviously doesn't do that anymore because that's not what they're about. Somewhere along the way, Facebook realized that the future is personalization. So of the key terms that I see really making an impact now in digital, it's things like integration, innovation, and personalization. And that's where social media really comes to play. So the thing about social media that you have to remember is that at its heart, it's social. It's about people talking to each other. And that's why Facebook is constantly pumping you with videos of you and your friend have been friends for 10 years. Share this little video now. You know, it's actually at its heart, Facebook's business is around people connecting. If that's with your friends and family, that's fine. If that's with your followers or your business, whatever it is, it's about building communities and networks. And so from a business perspective, if you can nurture those networks or be part of them or sell to somebody on that network in a way that makes sense, then you are the business that will win. For example, Facebook wants to know, I recently got engaged. They want to know when you got engaged and who you got engaged to, because they want to tell the product owners out there that this person's now ready to talk about weddings. Start pumping them with wedding products, you know, because I trust the system and I want to share with my friends and family that I got engaged. That's why it works. You know, the businesses that will win in the end are the ones that choose to take on social media from that perspective and understand it from a data perspective. And that's why social will only get bigger. Facebook, actually, I've seen a lot of studies on Facebook, and actually, do you know people access Facebook, millennials, something like 14 times a day? Can you think of anything else in the world that you do 14 times a day?
That's a huge number, isn't it?
It is indeed.
You don't eat that much. You don't go to the bathroom that much. This is why, as a platform, it's becoming incredibly important to our lives and our connection to our friends and family and our networks and our communities.
So if we bring this back to the sales process, is the digital sales funnel different for small business compared to large when you look at e-commerce and social and digital marketing? And what are those stages in the funnel?
Yes. What's really interesting is that big business is very traditional. You can Google the funnel. You know, at the top of the funnel, you're really doing awareness campaigns. So big kind of multinational businesses in Australia are doing very broad. We've got friendly customer service, TV ads. That's kind of the space that the awareness channels live in. So you can use things like social for awareness as well. That's where you might see the same TV ad you saw on TV, and you might see it come through your Facebook feed as well. But then as you go further down the funnel, at some point, you need to start finding your customers that are more willing to purchase. One of the key aspects to the funnel is knowing how long the purchase consideration phase goes for. So for example, if you do, let's say, cars, you're a mechanic and you know that once a year, somebody will need to get their car fixed. So if you know that your consideration funnel is 1 year, then you know when you need to start being in someone's awareness. So they start seeing your ads, then you start giving them good offers, they start reading reviews on your product, and then all of a sudden they're ready to purchase. So that's a really traditional funnel in that sense. So whether that's done between offline mediums and online mediums, I would say it would be a mix of both if it was a service business like mechanic. But for small businesses, what you actually do, because most of the time they don't have the kind of budgets that big businesses do, and they don't have, you know, this you're talking about now, the mechanic down the road that basically services the local area, he's way more likely to get a better return on his investment if he flips the funnel, goes after the people that are ready to purchase. So goes out with advertising that's more direct, that says, you know, do you need to get your car fixed before the end of the financial year? He's being direct. He might have a tradie offer. Tradies need to get their truck serviced before the end of the financial year, and he'll go out with a really targeted offer, but he'll go for the low-hanging fruit. And the three variables that I always talk about are time, money, or energy. And that's the same in big business or small business. Small business especially, because if you flip the funnel as a small business, you actually are putting your time and your energy into the customers that are more likely to purchase from you in the short term. And then once you've got time, you do things like awareness things, like sponsor the local football club or something, which is a long-term investment that might be more money, but over time will give you more leads.
Okay. So something that's been happening in the conversations around the episodes we've already released is that people who are not marketers are listening to the show and starting to think about how this applies to their job or their business, and they're asking questions about what do I do with this? So maybe you could give us some tips for small business considering doing digital, where they know they need to have a digital presence, they've even perhaps got some money set aside for it in this year's budget, but they just don't know where to start.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would always start with the basics. So, you know, don't forget to be on Google Maps. Just get onto Google and Google, how do I list my business on Google Maps? You know, it's the really basic stuff, like having your website appear, having your name in your website URL. There's really simple tricks you can do that will help small business show up higher on Google searches and be more relevant to local areas, if that's your audience.
You can pick up the phone and ring or email Google and ask them to do that for you.
That's brilliant.
I mean, I don't know. Is that how it works?
No, you actually go to a website and you put in your details and they send you a postcard for you to sign and say, yes, this is where my small business is. And you send the postcard back and then your business will be listed on Google Maps.
Because I always assumed that they did that automatically. I didn't realise that I had any influence over that whatsoever.
Yeah. So effectively what you're saying is go to Google Maps, look for listing my business, fill in the details, get the postcard, confirm that this is indeed my address of my business, and send it back so that when someone types in car servicing near me, that when the Google Maps results come up, yours is more likely to be there. Is that right?
Absolutely. Don't get caught thinking you need to have a really clever Instagram strategy if you haven't even got your Google Maps, your business listed on Google Maps. I would start with the basics. And also for small business, consider if you need to outsource skills you don't have. So if you have you want a little simple website that's going to look good if people search your business and are looking for reviews on your business, then just pay someone $1,000 to get it up and running quickly. Don't waste the time on a huge expensive website that you're never going to update ever again. You know, I would pick and choose your battles and get someone to give you advice on where to spend your time, energy, or money.
Awesome. So we've talked about the idea of moving online and the value of moving online with the selling process. We've talked about social, and we've also talked about sticking to basics and getting the basics right first when starting to move into a digital strategy. What are some of the top line messaging strategies that you use and you would suggest people look at when they're actually communicating with people at these stages of awareness, acquisition, consideration, and purchase?
Sure. So I guess the thing to keep in mind, and this is the really basic stuff, is think about what you want to buy yourself. And the one thing that people buy is benefits. So if I buy this product, it will give me what benefit? While features are really important and they are part of the funnel, there will be a point in the funnel, for example, if it's a really big purchase, you know, like insurance, or perhaps it's a buying an apartment, you know, there will be features, you know, it's got four bedrooms and it's got two bathrooms, that sort of thing. But the benefit of buying the apartment is you would get all these amazing views and you would be close to the beach and you could have a coffee shop downstairs. And people want to like envisage themselves buying that product and living the life that they see themselves in. And whether you are selling an apartment or you're selling Greek yogurt that's got probiotics and protein in it, and the benefit is that it will make you feel better and fill you up more, it's the same thing. You're selling the benefit of the product. So people sometimes, I see that on Facebook and digital a lot, that they sell too many of the features and they fill up all of the time online, because you've got to remember, people's attention span these days is so much less than it ever used to be. You know, a 60-second TV ad used to be really standard in the marketing industry and advertising. You know, you would always do a 60-second ad. I am talking about whether I can get my message into 6 seconds. It's still video and audio, but it's 6 seconds. It's not. And that talks about how long you have to sell people on your product these days.
Are you making a distinction between getting their attention, or do you think that's, you know, is the 6 seconds the end of the story? Because traditionally one would have thought, you know, you need to grab the attention first. And once you've got the attention, providing what you're offering to them is of interest, then they're open to a longer conversation. So you have an opportunity to make more of a sales pitch to them, so to speak. Or are you saying that online you don't really have that option?
So yes, the 6 second videos are part of a bigger digital strategy that actually is probably, you know, if that's probably just awareness, because you can't get much across in 6 seconds. It is really quick. And so what you have to do is either get them to click so that you can cookie them and then retarget them later, or get them to watch the 6 seconds so that later on YouTube, for example, you can actually follow them up with a 15 second and then a 30 second. And then hopefully, depending where they are in the funnel, you know, your 15 second might have more features or more benefits to the customer, and then they're coming down the funnel and thinking about buying your product. So maybe the 30 second will have more detail and more of a price and a special offer for that person, because you're trying to get them to buy, because they're getting close to the end of their purchase period. You want to make sure that they buy with you and the next person. So yes, a 6 second is definitely part of a bigger strategy, but it's important nonetheless to think about the way that those platforms work now.
And so effectively you're saying you have a different message for people that are at different stages of the purchase journey.
Absolutely, yes. And the features and benefits that you talk about along the way will be different. For example, so I have this strategy that I have always used in digital marketing, and it's basically how to market online. But it's not as easy as it sounds. You essentially have to market the right product at the right time, on the right channel, with the right offer to the right person. So if you work backwards, that's actually the funnel. So how do I give you, Ollie, an offer that resonates with you on a channel that you're willing to buy it? For example, how do I give you a 10% off offer on Facebook at 9 a.m. when you're on your way to work for a product that you've actually been researching for? And that's actually the whole strategy of digital marketing. Obviously, it's not that easy to do because it's very complicated. But at the end of the day, that's what we're all trying to achieve, is a personalized offer to you. So 5% off might resonate more with yourself than with Jeremy, but he wants $10 off. But actually, it's the same value, but it's just a different way of saying it.
It seems to me that what you said earlier was that actually it's the traditional ways of thinking, but just in a new environment. So the principles are still the same. It's just got a whole lot more complex, and the opportunities are much greater because of the nature of the online capability. Algorithms, sort of automated marketing, all that sort of stuff, does that make life a lot easier? Does that enable you to take advantage of this stuff? Or is that just another level of complexity you don't have to worry about?
Absolutely. Well, I love an algorithm because anything that's going to help me personalize my advertising more. So I always think, even if I come up with a whole offer, for example, for a group of people, even if that is only 20,000 people, if that is an offer that's going to resonate more with them and I can increase my conversions even to that small group of people, then that's absolutely worth my time. And so absolutely, it's just the channels that have changed and the personalization that has changed. What people still haven't got their head around is this kind of thinking of personalizing offers and trialing different offers. $10 off versus 5% off is a really simple one. Advertising to men and advertising to women is also one of the easiest things you can do on Facebook. You make the male advertising red and you put a big shiny red car in it. And you make the women's advertising, put some pink around it, put a beautiful Instagram model in there. And, you know, you can really start to learn things about your audience. That's a really simple strategy. You could give them both the same offer, but you personalize it at least to a level.
Mm. So when you were saying before that you're now seeing digital marketing become agile, is that what you're talking about? That test and fail fast and test again?
Yes, I mean, agile marketing is still something that's evolving, but agile is usually used in the term of building a technology business, so more of a digital business.
Okay.
Agile is actually a way to market. So it's actually a business strategy, for example, for old businesses to kind of get to market quicker. And you know, you ask, oh, where did Uber come from? You know, Uber would be an agile business. It's principles, actually. And the principles do flow over to marketing, but they start in the heartland, which is building the product. So, for example, in an agile business, everybody has a set of tasks. So the lawyers have tasks, they have to come up with the contracts, the marketers have to develop a whole new product and a card or whatever they're selling. The website people, they need to make a website and they need to make an app. Now, usually in a waterfall business, you would start with the contract. And once the contract's signed, then the business case would be put forward. And then the marketing people would start. And then the website, you know, website people would be given final copy and final images. And then they would go away and build the website. And a year later, you would go to market because everything was absolutely perfect. Whereas in agile, you are running at pace. And everybody is working at the same time on the same thing. And there's a little give and take. There's consideration of before we can put words on the website, marketing needs to write words, but there's an understanding that the words may not be final and approvals will be happening in real time. And the website people may have to go back and fix that as they go before. At the end, eventually, 18 weeks later, everybody's got a product they're happy with. The lawyers have signed their contracts. You know, the website's ready to go, the app is ready to go, and the marketing people are ready to go to market as well. So instead of taking a whole year for that process to happen in a waterfall way, agile says we can all work together at the same time, you know, doing those things. They're innovating quicker and getting to market quicker.
And I suppose there's something in here also about if you make a mistake, you can also change it very fast. You can react very fast. You can react in real time. As opposed to on market research, which means you've got to wait for 6 months before you get an answer to something.
And also, I think the understanding that businesses evolve. So in the big businesses that I've worked in, we use MVP, minimum viable product. So what is the minimum viable product offering that we are willing to go to market with? Well, they might buy the product for this and they may get that and they'll get this and this and this as well. But over time and learnings and good data, you understand that your customers are actually looking for X and you're losing them after 3 months because the data says that. And that way you can innovate. You know, you still not wasted any time. You just pivot and add a new offering and you get all those customers back. But you haven't held up the business going to market and starting to make money and become profitable.
One of the big changes seems to be the attitude to risk, whereas traditionally one would be much more conservative. Yeah. One would expect to get the product absolutely right, then you launch it, there's a lot of money put behind it and blah, 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 and you hope that, you know, it'll be fine. Now it seems people are much more prepared to make a mistake, confident enough to deal with the consequences of it and have the systems and processes around them, the technology, that allows them to react really fast.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, unbelievably yes. Being less risk-averse is the way to a more innovative, more personalised, more profitable future.
But if you're working on a B2B basis, is it the same? I mean, if you're an engineering company, for example, or if you're into producing IT software for big organizations, can you take that same approach?
I think there's a balance. I think, you know, I can't really talk too much to B2B as that's not my area of expertise. But you know, for software, for example, you could develop a beta program and test it in the market. And then if the market goes, oh my God, we were waiting for this our whole lives, you could develop the rest of the suite, for example. It's all about building a product in a basic form, testing the market to make sure there is customers for it. And then if you can, get them signed up, because you say, oh, in the next few years, we're going to release phase B, C, D, E, F, G. And they go, great, I'll take the whole lot. Or let's see how we go with phase A, which we've already built. And then we'll let you know if we're going to sign on. And then it becomes puts back on the main business, the IT business, to come up with a product and make sure they continue to innovate and integrate along the way so that their customer does stay with them. So that's another really big point, that it costs a lot more money to get new customers and new leads than it does to just improve your customer relationships with the customers you already have. So that's one way that digital can also help with bricks and mortar businesses, if you think about it like that.
Do you want to just explain that a little bit?
Yep. So for example, one of the big things that small businesses, I don't think they know enough about, is knowing their numbers. How much does it cost for them to create a lead? What is their hours worth? What is their hour as head mechanic? What is their hourly rate worth? They could be working on a car that's, the job is worth $1,000 an hour. But instead of doing that job, they're actually out the back trying to write their marketing website copy, where they could be paying an expert $200 an hour to write it, and it'd take that expert 3 hours. But instead, the head mechanic is sitting out the back trying to sweat over it for 6 hours, because it's not really what he does, and instead of doing the $1,000 job that would keep his business going. So it's all about knowing your numbers. What does a lead cost? What's the lifetime value of a customer to you?
Can you just define lifetime value? Because I think that's a good concept for people to understand.
Absolutely. So that talks around things like, what if someone becomes a repeat customer? Then also, what if they told one of their friends every year to come back to you? So again, if you're a local mechanic, what if you went the extra step this Christmas and bought any of your customers in December a $50 hamper, for example, and got it delivered to their house? It might cost you $50 to do that. But if they recommended you to just one of their friends, where their friend then went on to spend $1,000 with you, wouldn't that be cheaper than putting a $20,000 advertisement in the local paper that people either did or didn't see?
Interesting. Very good.
So it's all about, if you already have a base set of customers, how can you further use digital to either find people like them or service them better? So this is, you know, maybe not for a mechanic, but for any business where you buy one pillow, why wouldn't they want to buy five pillows? Maybe they don't need a pillow every year, but maybe they need a throw over rug or a lamp to match or whatever, you know.
I know you want to say Duna.
Duna, duvet. You know, it's all of those things. Like, if they bought one thing from you, why would they not keep buying from you? How can you give them offers to keep coming back? And if they don't come back, what did you do that was so terrible in the customer experience that they didn't want it? Was your product no good? Did the shipping take too long? Did you charge them for shipping when they didn't want to pay for it? Was there someone else that was better, faster, cheaper, and had a better product? You know, there's lots of things going on in the online space, but you can encourage those current customers to become more loyal through digital channels. Give them good offers, email them things, tell them how great they are.
It all seems to be predicated on data and having access to data and being able to interpret and work with data. But equally, I'm constantly being asked, when I go online and buy something, I'm constantly being asked for more and more information, and I get fed up with it. I don't want to give it. Am I alone in this, or are you finding some resistance? People are starting to, A, resent some of the sort of intrusion, or feel that it's rather intrusive if they can't see an immediate benefit to it, and B, this whole idea that people are becoming much more aware that their personal information is actually quite valuable, and the fact that they're just giving it away that enables someone then to come and sell me something, or they will sell my data to somebody else who can then come back and try and sell me something.
It's really fascinating. Data is my favorite thing to talk about these days, because do you know what's really fascinating is actually millennials and their data. Because everyone think, oh, these kids, they've grown up on swiping left and, you know, Tinder this and Instagram double clicking like, and, you know, but actually what we're seeing is the next generation is even more protective of their digital data than even one Ollie's generation or even your generation, Jeremy. Even though I think
just stating the obvious
in the most awesome way. But I mean it from a perspective of, I believe, you know, your generation that obviously didn't grow up with the internet, you know, perhaps maybe skeptical. Whereas Ollie and I perhaps have embraced it because it's come through in our age, we understand it. But, you know, when we teach our kids about it, we are absolutely talking about things like privacy and safety online. These issues are especially, you know, 10, 15 years in, whatever we are now, we've all seen those bullying on online and all that sort of stuff. And we actually are installing in our kids to be better protective of our online data than we ever were.
Yeah.
You know, I'm the worst for it. I sign in on Facebook with everything I possibly can because I don't want to have to remember a billion passwords. But actually the kids these days are using the Apple passwords better. They're doing everything better than we are. So,
yeah.
You know, I think it's an evolution, and also an evolution of being risk adverse as well in business, but also in our personal lives.
Yes.
And what's going to be the implication of that?
Ooh, I don't know. What do you think the implication will be?
Well, I think it's going to put your costs up, first of all, because I think people, you're going to have to start paying for data that in the past you'd have got for nothing. And I think that there's going to be legislation as well. I mean, because one of the things that people forget is that in your generation, you've been around this sort of thing for a while, most of your life. But actually, it's still very new. It's a bit like the Wild West, it seems to me, and everything is still evolving. And things that are created out of disruptive technology can die by disruptive technology. And something else is going to come along that's going to really upset the apple cart. And I'm just conscious that one has to keep your eye on those potentials rather than just believe that what's happening at the moment is going to protect you forever. That's not an answer, is it? But I think it just means that you have to be constantly flexible and you have to sort of anticipate what might change and ensure that you've got a diverse way of keeping your customer relationships and so on, which is, again, why I'm always interested in this notion of multiple distribution channels rather than just one.
So the only thing I would say to that is this has been a thread through my entire career, right? Working in tech and working in marketing, that people would say, we don't trust online, it's new. We don't trust sharing of data, it's new. We're not really sure if the internet will take off. Believe it or not, people used to say that. We don't really want to advertise online because we're already advertising offline. We got bus stop ads, we're in the newspaper, we're really excited about the newspaper ad and how much that's generated. What I think Agile is all about is also looking at that and saying, yes, we're not sure about it, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't test it.
Oh, absolutely. No, I'm all for testing and learning, and clearly you can't ignore something as significant as that. But just last week, I use Apple for everything. I've got Apple Macs and iPads and iPhones and all this sort of stuff, and I've always been brought up on the notion that it can't be hacked. Suddenly to discover that it can be hacked, and therefore they're all running scared at the moment, telling me I've got to download all this stuff because people are going to be able to access all my passwords and all my this and all my that. So that one email to me changed my perception of whether I should be that open with my personal data and things.
Absolutely. I think one of the things around data for me and that I tell to people is that data and putting more data into something like Facebook is around personalization. So you have to think about where the future will go with personalization. So don't think that it's just Facebook and Instagram, which are sending you, you know, because I'm engaged, they're sending me wedding ads. What I'm really excited about that's coming, and it's coming really soon, is Google Home and Alexa. So these are voice activated search products. So Google Home, for example, it's becoming really big in Australia. They're really cheap. You can get one with your phone contract for $8 a month. And that is an audio device sitting in your home, listening to you and about the products you say. And when you ask it, Google Home, find me car insurance, for example, what I want to know is how do you as a business get into the top two preferences that it tells me in my home for car insurance in Australia. Now, the way that devices come up with answers that are relevant is through personalization. They learn through algorithms the brands that I like. You know, what if I just wanted to buy soap? Hey, Google Home, buy me some soap. Hi, Robin, would you like to buy Dove soap for $4.99? It's free shipping and we'll be here in 2 days. Yes, buy. Now, why did that product give me that soap? Is it because they know that I buy that soap every week in my shopping online? Or is it because they know that I use that shampoo or that I watched a Dove ad 3 days ago on Facebook and liked it? You know, it's going to be the data that gets us there when these products are commonly used.
If you use those technologies, they only gave you an option of between, you know, of two products. I assumed that they give you lots and you can make a choice.
So I guess the question is how long do you have to sit there and listen to how many soaps are available to purchase on the internet? It's, again, a different medium to a laptop, for example, where you go onto Google and say, I want to buy soap and I want it delivered in 2 days. You get 55 million pages that you can sit there and scroll through. But really, you only look at the first page. So don't get me wrong, I'm sure it will keep listing options for you, but how long are you going to sit there? You know, there's been lots of research lately on how long people will sit on a website page, but what we don't know is how long will people sit there and listen to options to buy?
But I think it's the behavioural insight thing in this, which is, for me, I'm a cynic. So if I'm only given two options, I'm thinking not just, is that the best thing for me because they've noticed that that's the thing I always buy? Or am I thinking, actually, someone somewhere has offered them some sort of overriding discount or they're getting some sort of commissions? No different than in the insurance business, where you have tied agents, where you think they're looking at the whole market, but actually they're not. They're offering you a very selected range of products because they represent those particular companies. So I do think there's a sort of trade-off. And I think that, you know, the trade-off between the convenience and whether you trust the big brands, the Google or the Amazon, it's the level of trust you get in there. And I think that introduces a whole nother level of complexity. And I would be very nervous if I was brand number three or number four who wasn't getting onto this shortlist. And I'd be looking for alternative ways of getting to my client. You know, one of the other things I'm conscious of is that the internet, certainly in retail terms, seems becoming more and more dominated by a small group like the Amazons and the Googles and the eBays, and they're not sticking to what they did originally. They're starting to do other things. So Amazon is now starting to look at selling groceries. And before long, I mean, no doubt at some point it'll have an Amazon washing powder, or maybe even an Amazon insurance product, or an Amazon airline ticket, or whatever, because they will become a dominant brand. And that's what I think is quite damaging and quite dangerous. But also, it's going to provoke new innovations where people are saying, actually, we need an alternative to this. And I think, again, that will sort of change very fast. You'll have another disruptive technological breakthrough where the existing paradigm will just change overnight. Well, maybe not overnight, but you get my drift. I think there's some really interesting dynamics going on, and I'm not sure where it's going to end up.
If you get great customer service from Amazon and they have great products and you trust them and you get free shipping and they deliver in 2 days every time, then wouldn't you just buy from Amazon then?
I think
Amazon's just launched in Australia and there's lots of very nervous Australian businesses because they don't know what kind of impact they're going to have in this market. Now, globally, Amazon hasn't necessarily been as popular outside of America, but still, you know, Australia is thought of as a thought-leading market. So it'll be really interesting to see how it goes, you know, and that's where the personalization comes in. So what is it that Amazon does that adds the value or the X factor that people love? And what is it that Google does that adds the X factor? You know, you've got to remember when you type in you know, search soap on Google, the top four search queries are all paid for. People know that now. Those are advertisements. They are paying to be in that spot. And for really competitive, high-value industries, they are paying a lot to be there. Cars, all these kind of industries, you know, they pay a lot of money to Google every year to be at the top of that search funnel. Because if you are searching buy soap, you are ready to buy soap. You are at the bottom of the funnel. You are ready to purchase, even if they pay, you know, let's say your soap is worth $1,000. Even if they pay $300 for that soap, they are still making money.
Basically, what you're saying is that all these large manufacturers are becoming hostages of Google and Amazon, but don't have an alternative, which is why it's sort of forcing up the prices. Because essentially, these organisations are almost becoming monopolies. I'm not clear that that's going to be sustainable.
And I think there will come a time where they will have competitors and will eventually mean there needs to be more Googles out there. There will be a want for it. You're right. People will go, oh, I'm sick of Google. I don't want their email address. I don't want them to have my data. I don't want any of that. But at the moment, there's no alternative. So
exactly. We're hostages. I think technology will save us because there will be other technological developments that come along that save us from all of this.
I'm delighted to hear you say that, Jeremy.
Well, what's fascinating is how they got to that point. So have you ever noticed that most of Google's stuff is free? So it's free, have a Gmail. We'll look after your email account for you. It's free, have a YouTube channel. Put your videos on it. Follow the brands that you like. You know, what else do they do? There's so much stuff that Google puts out there for free, because they get the data so that when the big brand comes along and wants to know who's ready to buy a Ford Focus vehicle, that, you know, that data is absolutely the top-notch, credible, ready to pay for, hottest leads that they can possibly get. You know, what's interesting to me is how it works as a platform. Facebook provides a service and then they sell the data on top of that. Google is exactly the same, and Amazon is exactly the same as well. But what they've done right is provide the right service at the start of that. And then, sorry, what was the second part of your question?
It's about legislation and whether at some point there's going to be some constraints put on this to ensure there's more competition.
Well, I think governments are onto Google. You know, they're watching them pretty closely, but there's no reason why there can't be more Googles out there. You know, they just haven't been able to crack them. And I think there will come a time where they will have competitors, and Google are very aware of legally what they can and can't do out there on the world wide web. But I think,
what's the other name you have for that, Robin?
Well, when I go in and do speeches, I often ask the audience what they think www stands for. And then when they go, World Wide Web, I go, no, you're wrong. You're all wrong. And they go, oh, what do you mean? And I say, it stands for the Wild Wild West.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's And that to me speaks to, you know, it's a bunch of cowboys out there on the internet. You know, Google, Amazon, Facebook, these are all huge multinational companies. And these are all data points that are at our fingertips. And, you know, you can ride in on your big Tesla horse and, you know, use your voice activated device and sell more products and win at the end of the day if you have the right strategy to get there. And it's the wild, wild west because, you know, you can walk out with the cash and the swag and the girl at the end of the day. It just all depends on how you play your cards.
I'd like to walk out with the girl and the swag.
Oh, you just got to play it smart. And I think the trick here at the end of the day is don't try and do everything. Don't try and be, you know, the best mechanic on Facebook, or, you know, don't try and be on every platform, but just pick and choose the ones that you're going to do and do them well. And that at the end of the day will mean more to your customers than it will that they can find you on Instagram or they can find you on Facebook, for example.
Yeah. And if we just take this back to a listener who's thinking, right, okay, I can see that we need to do more in the digital space, and they're taking that to their management team or to their board, and they're saying, we need to put some money into Facebook, or we need to look at targeting people at different stages in the funnel, or we need to bring some marketing resource into the team. What would you say to them to help them in that conversation?
So what I would say is think more about your funnel and directly relate it to your business and where people are ready to buy and how much money you've got. And then for example, just be really good at one platform, maybe. Start with Facebook, start with Instagram, whatever makes sense. Don't try and do all of them terribly because you're running yourself too short. You know, I see a lot of small businesses really stressed because they're not posting on Instagram 14 times a day. And I say to them, it's not about doing that. It's about having a really solid engagement and understanding of how one channel works and how it benefits your business, and then making that ROI relevant to you and your business and making it work for you. You don't need to be everywhere. Your followers will find you, but you need to be able to be found as well. And then when they find you, make sure that you have the most amazing customer experience that you possibly can to make sure that they keep coming back to you. And that is the best way to use your marketing dollars.
We could obviously keep talking for days, and I think it'd be great to have you back to talk about a couple of specific things and dig a bit deeper. But coming to the end of this show, where can people find out more about you and your speaking and so forth?
Sure. You can always find me on LinkedIn. You can just search Robin Fawcett, or on Twitter, you can follow some of my ramblings on Robin Does Digi. So Robin Does you can Digi. Always bring back that hello.
Excellent. And and if it's okay with you, I think it'd be worth us putting together a bit of a cheat sheet on some of the things you were just talking about there, and having that available for folks to download.
Brilliant. Absolutely.
Brilliant. Listen, thanks ever so much, Robin. That's been an education.
No worries. I'm glad I could help.
Always a pleasure. Talk to you soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.